The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 22nd, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday. Joining us to look back on this week, Jamelle Bouie, opinion columnist at the New York Times and co-host of the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. Also on the program today, primetime January 6th committee shows Trump's complicity in the Capitol attack and features Josh Hawley's jogging skills. Meanwhile, Department of Homeland Security Inspector General launches a criminal probe into the Secret Service text destruction. And number four, it's not just Joe Biden. COVID cases have shot up across the country. Hospitalizations and deaths up over 20% in the past 2 weeks. House passes a bill to ensure contraceptive rights. Only 8 Republicans vote in favor. Meanwhile, California to pass a law providing a bounty to successful lawsuits against gun manufacturers and distributors. Turkey says Ukraine and Russia to sign a deal today allowing Ukraine grain to be exported. It's 20 million tons to relieve hunger shortages, food shortages around the world. Amazon workers in North Carolina begin a union drive. Miami bans sex education books in its schools over don't say gay fears. In Oklahoma, librarians are told not to use the word abortion or provide reading resources on how to obtain them. And lastly, it appears that I have gotten the last phone call of my life, as the FCC orders U.S. phone companies to block all car warranty robocalls. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Casual Friday. You can tell by the soft-collared shirt I am wearing. And joining me here with, I can't even, is it like basically no
collar? It's linen.
Linen. Yes. Wow. Linen. Emma Viglin.
Yeah, just in the lightest fabric possible as we're, you know, riding out this heat wave here in New York.
Indeed. And the robocalls thing is...
it's a huge blow.
It's a huge blow to me. I will not ever get a phone call again.
And, but on the bright side, prep is going to go a little bit smoother because Sam won't be trying to impromptu record him harassing somebody who's trying to scam him.
Yeah, that's true.
I have a few cell phone videos of you being like, hey, get this.
Yeah.
When your camera wasn't working. And then maybe I'm going to squat on those and release them at a different time.
Well, that's great. Let's put them on the YouTube channel.
Yep.
We'll see if that works out. I got to say, after last night, got to be very, very careful about outtake videos. Got to be sure to destroy those.
Jag and Josh.
No bloopers.
Jag and Josh.
Let's get into this. We've got a lot of clips from the January 6th hearings. They have decided to extend those till September.
And
which I think is a smart move. There's a lot of, I mean, there's, and we'll talk to Jamelle about this. A lot of lessons, I think, from these hearings. But let's just start with Fox and Friends, because this, they always, and it's been a while since I feel like we have been, you know, playing any Fox and Friends clips, but you always get a sense of sort of just cool. like what the panic level is, and, you know, on the right from certain things via Fox and Friends. And today, I think, is no different. Let's play. This is clip number 6.
Cool. Yeah, so they're going to try to get this right up to November and try to drag this out as long as possible. It is their strongest political play is January 6th.
Just keep in mind, everyone in that room, they're all against Trump. They're anti-Trumpers. Every single person in that room voted to impeach him.
Right. But there were some people from insiders that give the account, coming to testify. And it's really interesting because now the schism between Pence and Trump is huge, huge gulf, because they played out what Mike Pence was calling out and what the president wasn't doing. And that's why I think Mike Pence is running for president. He's actually in Arizona, and he's trying to actually, I can't believe we're at this point. He speaks during the Washington Post today, how he's trying to separate himself from President Trump.
There's an item in the New York Post this morning that talks a little bit about the Secret Service agents who were with Mike Pence that day. When they were actually, they heard the people coming, they knew they were really close. And according to the story, the Secret Service agents were calling their loved ones to say goodbye because they were so convinced that the rioters were going to kill him. And so they were saying goodbye. Thankfully, you know, they didn't get to the vice president.
There's no excuse for a riot. But remember the summer of 2020 when there were all those riots? Wow. Where are the hearings for those riots? For people, you know, burning buildings and burning businesses. You can't.
Yeah, let's just pause it for like 1 second, because one, I mean, it should be noted. Is she still with Sean Hannity romantically?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know.
That is a good question. I had forgotten about that.
Because Sean Hannity was all over those hearings last night. Text going to Mark Meadows, in and out, in and out. Sean Hannity is a character in these hearings. So her dismissiveness of this is personal in many ways. But she's pissed, right? Like, even Kilmeade doesn't have her back here. When she says, anti-Trumpers, they're all anti-Trumpers who vote to impeach Trump. That's not even true. That's not the case at all, because the people that were testifying were not members of Congress or senators. They were people that worked for him.
His own aides, like his own staff.
Absolutely
true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. And it really is fascinating, because you do get the sense, I mean, Ducey is, he is not with the program whatsoever. Mm-mm. And Kilmeade seems to be like, you know, like pacing himself, but you start to get the sense that they're realizing they're going to cut bait here from Trump, except for, of course, Ainslie, who's like, there's no excuse for a riot, but let me see if I can work one up right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. And that was also something that, like, it was a good reminder in the testimony last night. There was one staffer who was saying how he resigned because he was disappointed because of Donald Trump's lack of support for the police, because we have to condemn all violence against police because of all the riots that happened over the summer and the disrespect there. So, like, just a good reminder that, you know, all of these characters in this, the Republicans who are by Trump's side, are still horrible, horrible human beings, even though, you know, they're serving this function for us right now.
Without a doubt. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't get into this situation. And this, you know, it's not like they didn't know this was coming. Right. I mean, remember that testimony that we heard from Meadows, right hand woman, that Trump's attorney was talking as early as January 2nd, that, like, we could all get arrested for this and we could all go to jail. They're talking about this 4 days before the thing happened. So they knew what was afoot. And they realized at one point, like, they don't want to be rounded up. All right, let's continue to this clip.
Is the good one, and which one's the bad one? They're all bad, and they all need to be. All these people, Kamala Harris was raising money to get all of these people out of prison that were thrown in jail for rioting. So, and then you had Chuck Schumer on the steps saying to go after the Supreme Court justices, and a guy does, and is attempting to assassinate
Kavanaugh.
So. You know, you can't pick and
Chuck
choose.
Schumer's
we
orders.
Have to go after all the violent crimes and all the criminals out there.
I thought Mark Levin had a good point with Sean last night.
What
he said the whole goal is to make it impossible for Trump to run again. Sure. And that's the whole goal, make that argument.
All right. It is exactly 6:21 here in the East.
They got nothing.
And we'll talk about this with Jamel Bowie. But there's some polling that shows that, like, and it's hard to disaggregate exactly what this is, that this is having a real impact on Republican voters and a key demographic for Republican voters, and that it's not just hurting Donald Trump, that it's actually hurting the Republican Party. But we will get to that with Jamel. But the obviously, I mean, I think it goes without saying, there is a fundamental difference between just generic violence and violence that is been coordinated by the most powerful people in our government to usurp another branch of government. That's we get a special name for it. It's a coup, and they're beautiful people. We love them. but that's the fundamental difference here. You know, people can have, you know, take issue with property damage that took place during protests about policing, I suppose, if they want, and they can take issue. Obviously, we should not have randos going after Supreme Court justices or members of Congress, for that matter, as in Pramila Jayapal. But the bottom line is, when you have one branch of government that is basically getting brown shirts or, you know, thugs to go and intimidate another branch of government, that's a real problem. Apparently that is Ashley. I don't know what's going on. Ainsley, whatever her name is, Hannity's girlfriend. I guess they've been, talking about it and trying to work something out that they can get some talking points. It's not very good, going very well.
Yeah.
The what about Black Lives Matter response is like, it's amazing. Ainsley's like really representing her audience with that there.
Yep.
And, she can't even really do it convincingly too, right?
The problem is with her audience is that they don't have, there's no way for the Fox audience to think less of people who are marching on behalf of Black Lives Matter. But there's a lot of room for them to lose respect for Republicans and Trump. And that's the dilemma they have. Mm-hmm. That's why deploying that just isn't as effective as they want it to be. But we'll talk more about that with Jamel. First, a couple of words from our sponsors. One is a product that I used just this morning when I brush my teeth. I brush my teeth every morning.
Good job, Sam.
Thank you, Emma. I appreciate it. And every evening. And sometimes I'll do it three times a day, but it's generally twice a day.
All right.
But I
try less hard here.
I do it. Well, wait a second. I do it when I travel. But I also floss every day. Why? Because Quip has designed a toothbrush, a flosser that is easy to use. I've said this many, many times. Quip gets your smile ready. It makes good habits easy. This is the key to brushing your teeth and good dental hygiene. You need to do it every day. And you need to do it well every day, and Quip makes it possible, not just for me, but also for my kids. The Quip electric toothbrush uses timed vibrations with 30-second pulses to guide a dentist-recommended 2-minute clean. It is loved by over 7 million mouths. Many of those mouths are in my family. You can even upgrade to a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing and earn sweet rewards. You can also get, like I do, the matte black. It's a all black toothbrush. It just looks cool. You build your whole routine with even more Quip, like the reusable floss pick, which I think is one of the most ingenious devices I've ever seen. Or their refillable mouthwash, so you can say goodbye to those huge plastic containers. And here's the key with Quip. They deliver your brush heads, they would deliver you new fresh floss and other refills every month for just $5, no extra shipping costs. The whole point is you need to do it. You need to be able to form a habit and keep with it, never have any type of interruption. And that's what Quip does. They're an amazing design company that focus on your dental hygiene. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. That's spelled GETQUIP.com/majority. Quip is the good habits company. Also, today's program sponsored by ZBiotics. ZBiotics is a probiotic drink that breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for rough mornings after drinking. I didn't know this. We talked about this the other day. I thought it was you get dehydrated after you drink, and that's why you feel sick. That's not it. Basically, in your gut, the alcohol creates some type of toxins that make you feel lousy the next day. So here's what you do. You drink a bottle of ZBiotics before you go. You have your first drink of alcohol at night. It's a little tiny thing, like maybe that big, would you say? That big?
Yeah, it's like a little shot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one bottle is all you need. Doesn't matter whether you have one drink or multiple ones. You drink responsibly, as you always do. You pace yourself. You get a good night's sleep. And here's the thing. The next day, you feel completely fine.
Mm-hmm.
Totally refreshed.
Interesting.
Ready to make the most of it. Here's how it works.
Matt's salivating at this prospect.
I know. Well,
I mean, I need this now.
I went through, actually, like, I don't know. I gave Emma one. And I think there was like another four or five in the
I was like, do you have another? And you said you used them all.
No, nope.
I used them all. Well, because after the first time, like, you know, if I have a drink the next day, I very often don't feel so great. So I, you know, during the week, I don't do that. But occasionally I get invited across my buddy's house. We go, we have a little bit of a glass of bourbon. And I tried the ZBiotics. It worked. And so then I was able to try it more often. I don't drink that much at all, but it's like it really makes a difference. And like I say, the way that ZBiotics works is it produces an enzyme. It's like the one your liver uses to break down that toxic byproduct. And ZBiotics is the first genetically engineered probiotic. It's created by altering the DNA of a natural probiotic bacteria that we eat all the time. ZBiotics is not vitamins. It's not plant extracts. It's no off-the-shelf ingredients. ZBiotics has been rigorously tested and is FDA compliant for safety. If you're the kind of person who enjoys drinks with friends, you want to unwind at the end of the day, still have a full day planned tomorrow, ZBiotics is perfect for you. Doesn't matter whether you want tomorrow to be a productive one, a fun one, a relaxing one, or if you want to go work out. Don't let the few drinks the night before ruin it. You can get 15% off your first order of ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic. Go to ZBiotics.com/majority. Use the code majority. That's the letter ZBiotics.com/majority. Coupon code majority at checkout saves you $15. We'll put the link in our podcast and YouTube description as always. And lastly, today's program also sponsored by SunsetLakeSebade.com. Left is Best gets you 20% off. 20% off Left is Best at SunsetLakeSebade.com. You can check out their tinctures. You can check out their flowers, their kief, their pre-rolls. You can check out their fudge or their gummy bears. They have gummy bears with melatonin. They have sour gummy bears just for chilling out. They have coffee with sebade. It has become a mainstay for me. The pre-rolls, the tincture, the melatonin, gummy bears.
Is that 20% for everything?
20%, all of it.
Wow.
Is off. A Left is Best. And you can check out They have third parties that test all of their products, give you exactly the ingredients that are in there, the percentages of the various chemicals that you find in CBD, all natural chemicals, of course. They do not use pesticides. They use integrated pest management and organic fertilizer. They use integrated, regenerative farming practices, and they're great movement partners. They've donated over $25,000 over the past couple of years to things like soup kitchens and union strike funds and Innocence Project and against the organizations that fight against the drug war. Just a great, great company. SunsetLakeCBD.com, 20% off. All right. Do we need to take a quick break?
Yeah, let's just take a quick break, and then we'll bring Jamel in.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Jamel Bowie, opinion columnist at New York Times, co-host of the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome back to the program Jamel Bowie. He's an opinion columnist at the New York Times, co-host the Unclear and Present Danger podcast. Jamel, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
I want to get to the January 6th hearings and what's going on with the Biden plus the generic thing. But let's talk about what's happening in the Senate for a moment. You wrote about Joe Manchin, obviously, you know, killing his latest proposal.
Eating his own, which he doesn't really care about.
the sheer dysfunction that is the Senate. And we're seeing this also. I mean, there's just a lot of extraordinary things happening right now over the past month and a half that I think are, I don't know, I feel like I've been saying this quite a bit over the past really 6 years, relative to back in the day where things seemed to be more sort of two or three dimensional as opposed to like seven dimensional.
Yeah.
But just give me your sense of like what's happening with the Senate. We're going through a heat wave now in this country. Europe is on fire. There's just total inaction on this like massively urgent sort of a crisis we're facing.
Right. Well, you know, obviously Manchin is trying to triangulate against the National Democratic Party in this weird way of making proposals. And then as soon as other Democrats agree to the proposal, it's like, well, now it's too liberal, so I have to back off of it. But I think that's more just a symptom of the fundamental problems with the Senate itself. The Senate was designed, right, to be quite elitist, designed to shut down unpopular legislation. That's more or less the function it has served. Giving every state, right, an equal say on legislation, allowing the Senate to originate legislation, really gives it this powerful veto over popular legislation out of the House, which is unlike any other upper house in any other democracy. Like, no other country works like this. And I don't think it's a surprise that no other country's legislature seems to be so ill-equipped to function. Because it's beyond kind of the structural things of the Senate. It's just if you've observed them over the last 4 or 5 years, what's striking is just like how much they don't seem to want to work, right? Sort of like how much there's like this, you know, we got to go on recess, we got to go campaign. But there's like this real desire to not want to do anything. And to kind of just like rest on laurels and enjoy the perks. And I think it's all, I mean, I think you're seeing that with Manchin. I think Manchin enjoys very much being the center of attention, and that's sort of like what he's doing. Maybe it's ideological, maybe it has something to do with his pocketbook, but I think kind of the big thing is he's a bit of a diva, and this gives him a lot of attention to be at the center of negotiations. And that kind of attitude, I think the Senate encourages. And it's just not good for lawmaking or legislating or anything like governing. And accordingly, you know, even, you know, the House under Pelosi the past couple of years, there's lots to criticize, but it's been much more productive in terms of actually doing something compared to the Senate.
Well, that raises actually, there's the three points. One, we should always mention that, you know, Manchin has gained, I don't know, close to 20 points in favorability since embarking on this project of being the Democrat thwarter. The second thing that occurs to me as you say that is, you know, Dick Durbin had a quote the other day. They were asking whether the Senate would deal with the sort of, I guess you call them at this point, wedge votes in terms of protecting abortion rights and protecting contraception and protecting marriage equality. We should say the contraceptive bill only passed with 8 Republican votes, which is stunning to me. There was 47 that they had in terms of the marriage equality. And Durbin was asked, are you guys going to vote for this? And he's like, well, we really should, but you know, we don't have that much time left in the calendar because we got to go on vacation. And I'm just like thinking, like, are you kidding me?
Right.
Like, on one hand, you're sending out all these emails saying the planet's on fire, and on the other hand, you're saying like, well, some folks really want to, you know, I don't know, go to their, you know, their lake house or whatever it is. Like, it's insane.
Right. No, I agree. It's you have to ask, like, what are you even there for? Like, if going on vacation is more important than at the very least putting your opponents in a tough spot, your opponents who have embarked on an extremely unpopular crusade here and sort of outlawing abortion and going after contraception and really putting them on the spot ahead of the midterms, you would think that that's a thing that they would want to do. But there's like this disconnect between what appears to be at least politically intelligent and sort of the attitudes, the habits that the Senate develops in its members, which is this like chumminess and going along to get along, and I think laziness. I mean, I really think that a defining attribute of the Senate is just a profound laziness among the members.
But isn't part of it, too, there's a fundamental, I think, belief, not on with every member of the Senate, but with, say, a Mark Warner or a Joe Manchin, that they are a stoppage on the rabble rousers and the direct democracy action that if the House was running the show, which I would prefer, that would create, right? Like, that's why they're so committed to the filibuster, because that is another mechanism by which they can hold the reins back on democracy, essentially. And for the most part, what that largely does is protects moneyed interests. And so that's why someone like Manchin is successful in his role in the Senate, frankly.
I think that's right. And it's entirely asymmetrical, too, right? It's not as if when Republicans hold both chambers of Congress, they sort of resist the kinds of legislation coming out of the House. Like, if there's agreement on a policy platform among Republicans, they pursue it. It's only among Democrats, and really due to, you know, the wide, you know, the broadness of the Democratic coalition, that the Senate or Democratic senators feel this need to act as like this backstop on things coming out of the House, even though it's never been politically successful for them, right? Like, you can't actually count the time when killing something that came out of the House or delaying some important piece of legislation or undermining the Democratic president's agenda. You can't think of a situation in the past 30 years when this has ever been successful for Senate Democrats or Congressional Democrats. And yet they persist at it. And I think it's sort of mindless at this point. I don't think they know how to do anything else.
Why is there no? Is there a price that is paid? I mean, I guess I have a three part question for you. Is there a price that is paid? Does the House? You mentioned the House had been very productive, but sometimes they're productive at the expense of using their leverage with the Senate, right? I'm thinking about they passed the Build Back Better bill. Well, that's all well and good, but everybody knew that if they split it up, the chances of the Senate doing it would be nil or pretty close to nil. I know they got promised by the White House, et cetera, et cetera. But should the House, and I don't think it's going to happen under Nancy Pelosi's leadership, but I'm thinking in the future, should part of the House's job be to not just pass legislation on their own, but to do it in a way that leverages the politics in terms of the Senate? And also, aside from that, like, what? How do we penetrate this, like, as like voters and people, and citizens? Like, how do we penetrate this this sort of, like, I don't know, this rampart that is the Senate?
So as far as whether there's a price to pay, I think there is a political price to pay. I think you can at least trace some of Biden's declining approval ratings to the fact that it seems as if there's just complete stasis in Washington. And I think that owes itself to the Senate. I think, you know, Manchin might have improved his approval ratings with West Virginians, but his colleagues are not really doing well under this status quo where the Senate just doesn't look like it's doing anything. I think that in terms of what the House should do, I think you're right to suggest that the House should just, like, be more aggressive with regards to the Senate. You know, what political scientists say, that the United States party government, right, sort of like the House and the Senate don't really operate as, separate institutions that are, like, jealous of their authority. It's like whatever party controls them tries to coordinate with their fellow party members in the other House. But I think it'd probably be worth for the House, not under Pelosi, but under some future leader, to begin being much more aggressive with the House's powers and much more aggressive about, like, pressuring the Senate and pressuring the White House into actually, you know, doing something. And as far as what the public can do, I mean, what's interesting, I think, is that public complaints, public disapproval of the Senate's, slow movingness, all these things, I think it's actually begun to have an effect, not so much on currently serving senators, or at least the marginal ones that we need to actually move. But, like, you look at John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, you look at Tim Ryan in Ohio, you look at any Democrat running for Senate anywhere, no one supports the filibuster, right? Like, no one supports, none of the Senate aspirants support the kinds of obstructionist procedures that a Manchin or a Sinema does. And so I think that, you know, I think we're witnessing the last group of Senate Democrats who have some commitment to these procedures. I think future crops of Senate Democrats will just dismiss this stuff as not needed, as useless.
Yeah, I would say even as obviously as detrimental. I mean, this is right. The way that you sort of, like, obscure what is happening in the Senate, I think, from people. Let's talk about the January 6th hearings to a certain extent. I mean, but in the context of something that's sort of fascinating that's going on, the Joe Biden's polling is nearly as bad as I think I've ever been around an American president's polling. I mean, you know, George Bush hit some pretty low lows, and I think Carter did too, although I don't know if it was even this low. But he's in, he is like not liked by a lot of people, or at least unfavorable as president. But it's almost like divorced from what's happening with the Democrats and the Republicans. And on top of that, the polling is just, there is, I mean, part of it is abortion, but part of it, I think, is also the January 6th hearings. There's a poll that just came out, CNN and SSRS. 47% of those age 65 and over said they'd vote for the Republican candidate if the midterm congressional election in their district was held today. And this is over age 65, 49% said they would vote Democratic. And that that was 15 points reversed in May. In May, it was two-thirds, 62% of 65 and over said they'd vote for a Republican, and 37% said they would vote for a Democrat. May to July, it must be the January 6th hearings, right? I mean, I don't know, or and abortion, I guess.
I think it's probably a combination of the two, right? Sort of, again, Republicans have embarked on this extremely unpopular project. Like, every day there are new stories of horrible things happening to women and girls who are pregnant, who need abortions, who need, you know, miscarriage care or ectopic pregnancy care. So that's obviously reaching the public, and people are responding very negatively to it, as you would expect them to. But I think you're right that the January 6th committee has also, it's made an impact. And that's sort of, I mean, one of the arguments during the Trump years, I think, among Democrats was between those who thought that the path back to power for the Democratic Party was to focus on, you know, kitchen table issues and things that matter to American families, you know, create a spectacle around Trump's corruption criminality, and that voters would respond negatively to Trump if you create that spectacle. And I think what we're seeing with the January 6th committee is like evidence that the latter view was correct, that creating a spectacle over the January 6th insurrection, which is what these committee hearings are. I mean, I'm sure you guys watched the ones last night where they showed that video of Josh Hawley running away. Yes. Which is very funny.
Let's play that right now.
Yeah.
Let's just play it, because it is, we haven't played it yet, and it is really funny. In fact, there was a clip, I don't know if we have that clip too. There was a clip of like people laughing. I don't know if that was like, it was like,
yes, the gallery, like people who were watching just burst out in laughter.
But here is the
Jug and Josh. That's what it's going to be on the campaign trail.
Here is a clip of Josh Hawley. Remember, Josh Hawley, given the solidarity power sign to these folks when they were outside, and then giving the I'm exiting stage
prancing away.
right.
Yeah, and that power sign was when he was behind a barricade of cops. So what a tough guy this guy is.
You're my people. Don't hurt me.
Senator Josh Hawley also had to flee. Earlier that afternoon, before the joint session started, he walked across the east front of the Capitol. As you can see in this photo, he raised his fist in solidarity with the protesters already amassing at the security gates. We spoke with a Capitol police officer who was out there at the time. She told us that Senator Hawley's gesture riled up the crowd, and it bothered her greatly, because he was doing it in a safe space, protected by the officers and the barriers. Later that day, Senator Hawley fled after those protesters he helped to rile up stormed the Capitol. See for yourself.
Yeah. There we go. Running away. Running
down some stairs.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. All right, I just put the
reaction
the reaction in the gallery. This is pure gold. Check this out. Do we have it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here it is. Pop it up. People texting each other.
Oh my god! I mean,
it again. Just play it again.
Yeah, play it again. Go ahead.
You want to run for president? You like that, to run. We all know you like
running.
To run.
He's jogging, running.
Josh.
So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that catches people's attention, yes. And it filters down to the public. And I think it's helping build an image of the entire Republican Party, or at least everyone aligned with Trump, that's really negative for the party. And I think that is probably affecting its approval ratings, because the divergence between Biden's approval and sort of the Democratic performance from the generic ballot is unprecedented. We haven't really seen this before. And I think it's what it signals is that while Biden might be very unpopular, so is the Republican Party. And given the choice, at least at this point, voters would rather have Democrats in office than they would Republicans because of the unpopularity of the Republican Party.
You know, it's interesting because, I mean, look, this is happening from May to July. And folks who are over age 65 would be much more likely to have been aware of a pre-Roe world.
Right.
And they would have been much more impacted by they're 15 years old at a minimum when Roe is overturned. I mean, or I should say is established. And so they could be far more sensitive to this. But what strikes me about to the extent that it's from January 6th is that one of the other, I mean, you mentioned there were two sort of strategies, right, by the Democrats. Do you make a spectacle out of Trump? Do you let's do this huge bill where we're going to vote in the House on, 45 different proposals that, people really, each chair of each committee can tout to their own people. But there's also like a sort of a subcategory of the Trump one is, do you like bind the Republican Party to Donald Trump?
Right.
And that, I think there was a huge failure to do that by the Democrats starting in the summer of 2016. I mean, Chuck Schumer was bragging about having, I think the exact quote was something like, I've got Schumer, because he refers to himself in the third party for whatever third person, Schumer, Ryan, and Clinton, and we're going to do the tax repatriation deal. I mean, going way back here. But they wanted to protect, I think, Ryan and McConnell and allow, Trump to sort of pass through. And there was never that conjoining people. But the interesting thing that happened with January 6th is no Republicans end up on the committee, except for Kinzinger and Cheney, who have been ostracized. They're in the leper colony of the Republican Party. And so it's had this effect in a multiple ways, both in the operation of the committee and on the politics. What's your sense of that in terms of like, it's one thing to say, like, I no longer like Donald Trump, but it's another to say, like, I don't like the Republicans as a function of these hearings.
Right. I mean, I think even if this wasn't necessarily the intent, connecting the insurrection to a wide range of figures within the Republican Party, the fact that Republicans aren't on the committee and were even opposed to it, I think all those things do in themselves create this connection. Democrats are very afraid of appearing too partisan, but I think that this sort of partisan spectacle is actually very effective. And it's very effective because it breaks through all the noise of everyday life in American politics. It makes people pay attention. Most people have, if they have no interest in politics, they have too many things going on to bother paying off that much attention. So to grab them, you need to do something that is dramatic. And this is dramatic. I think voters are kind of naturally making the connection between January 6th committee and Republican Party. I think Democrats could do more to say, you know, if you don't want these people, right, like Jim Jordan and Kevin McCarthy, if they win, if Republicans win the majority, will be top leaders in the House of Representatives. If you don't want these Trump pro-insurrection acolytes to be, you know, hold that kind of power, you have to vote for Democrats. And just to kind of say that again and again and again, and do things that capture people's attention, even if they're very partisan, even if they're going to engender a little backlash from like the mainstream press, like who cares, right? Well, like I think real quick, I'm always loath to give Trump credit for anything, but one thing I will give Trump credit for is a recognition of this dynamic in American politics, that what matters most is making the splash. And then after that, once you have the attention, that is the important thing.
Yeah, 100%. Their message is undercut by Nancy Pelosi going out every second and saying, well, we need a strong Republican Party, right? And Biden saying, this is not the real Republicans. But even with that messaging being so convoluted, the committee's findings are so powerful and frankly well put together that it overrides it. And the fact that MSNBC and CNN are wall-to-wall covering this, and it was on ABC News last night, and I think it was on CBS, wherever you look, it's just a taste of what Republicans have been doing for decades with Fox News, which is just blitzing the media with their narrative. And you see the effects of that in the polling, as Sam pointed out. It moves things when you are unabashed in your message on a particular issue set. You're actually doing politics.
Right. My preference would be for Democrats to have, you know, during the Trump years, to have had like a standing committee on Trump corruption that is just like constantly holding public hearings. But since that's already past that, to at least not wrap this thing up, to just like keep it going as long as possible, sort of like, you know, keep investigating. Because here's the other thing. I think Democrats have this like weirdly mechanistic vision of what politics is, or at least like some congressional Democrats, which is that, like, you know, there is the economy, and, you know, when it's up, people like us; when it's down, people don't like us. You know, if we investigate something and there isn't like an immediate effect, then it's not really worth doing, because like if it was, then we'd go up, and so on and so forth. But what we've seen with this committee is that just the mere act of doing the investigation, doing it publicly, has surfaced more stuff, right? Like people start coming forward with more stuff, which becomes more grist for the mill. It takes on a life of its own, that can be quite powerful. I mean, this is basically what happened with Bill Clinton, right?
Yeah.
Like the beginning, like, you know, investigations end up yielding more investigations. And while it is true that Clinton wasn't like, you know, Clinton wasn't like fatally harmed by all of this, and Democrats ended up taking some seats in the 98 midterms, I think it did serve at least Republicans to generate energy for their party and help them win a big midterm victory in 94. And I think it helped them win in 2000 by like tainting Al Gore with the stench of scandal.
Well, that's why Al Gore chose Joe Lieberman, which alienated part of his base. I mean, there was without a doubt. I mean, it had a ripple effect that you can't, that is intangible. But I would also add Benghazi to that, because, you know, they had Benghazi, but people forget the whole server thing for Clinton Hillary Clinton came out of the Benghazi hearings. And this is the first example that I've seen where Democrats, and part of it is, sad to say, it's because I would imagine it's because they're in part being driven by two Republicans who understand this dynamic. You know, like, right. I will take a second place to no one in terms of my disdain for Liz Cheney.
Liz
Cheney. I always have to think, but for both of them, frankly, but Liz and Lynn, but they know how to do this. Right. You know, in 2019, she's out there, you know, leading a press conference talking about how Democrats are cheering on people killing babies after they're born. I mean, she's literally saying this, and she knows exactly how to do this without any sort of like self-consciousness, or she just is going for it. Now, it, you know, she, and the other thing that strikes me is that, you know, I was thinking about the, and you hear Kinzinger and Cheney will use the clown car. They set up that dichotomy between the sort of like the normal Republicans and the Trump Republicans, when in fact, it's really just the regular, you know, it's just like it's, they're all Republicans. That's just the way the Republican Party works. There's slightly, you know, some are slightly more unhinged than others. But the open lane that the committee has without having Republicans on there who are against the existence of the committee, like this idea, and I wonder, maybe it's just hopeful thinking that maybe the Democrats will get this idea that like, we don't have to be bipartisan. You know, like I doubt they'll get the idea from it, because they're like, well, we had the cover of allowing for them to be, but does anybody remember who's watching this? Anybody, like, is there any of these seniors, if they've turned because of the committee, thinking like, this is only legitimate because Pelosi had offered an independent commission first and they rejected it and then said, put people on. But the Republicans were so irresponsible in putting people on who were going to have to testify, maybe. Like, no, nobody remembers that.
Right.
But I don't know if the Democrats will get that lesson from this.
Right. Or at least they don't have to be substantively bipartisan. You can, whatever, you can say whatever. But when it comes to actually doing the thing, no one cares. No one pays attention. And I would hope that the Democrats learn that lesson from all of this. I think this committee, the January 6th, everything, it should be an important lesson for congressional Democrats on how to do politics in a way that resonates with the broad public. I think that if Democrats end up doing better than they expect in the midterms, I think we'll be able to make a good case that this committee, stretching out through most, you know, half the year, ends up playing an important part in shaping the overall media environment for how people think about the Republican Party. I think Biden, if he wanted to improve his approval, should start picking fights with Republicans. When that story about that that little girl had to go to Indiana to get an abortion came down, and Biden talked about it. He was like this, he expressed his sort of horror at it in a press conference, and then sort of, you know, the Republicans and much of the right had a total meltdown. They were trying to disprove the story, say that it was fake. And then it was obviously it came out, you know, this is a true story. This really happened. We have all the documentation. I thought that was a political win for the White House. I think that kind of thing works because it puts your opponents on the defensive. When Biden was it last year when he was like pushing for the voting rights bill, and he asked if Republicans wanted to be like with Bull Connor, and they all got very huffy, and Mitch McConnell would be like, well, I'm not Bull Connor. I think if you can get the leader of the Senate Republicans to like say, I'm not Bull Connor, I think you're
exactly,
like doing something right. And so that's the kind of approach you have to take, which requires people to like let go of this bipartisanship, let go of this notion that the thing here is like maintaining our friendly relationships with the opposition, because they don't particularly care. Like, that, you know, Mitch McConnell doesn't care about being friendly. Mitch McConnell's reputation for ruthlessness and genius, I think, is really just he has figured out how this game works, and he's willing to play it with no apologies. And there's no reason his opponents can't do the same.
All right, I just want to talk about one other thing too that you wrote about this past week, which was that the bill, a bipartisan bill. 16 senators got together, including, I think it was Manchin and Collins were leading this, on a reformation, at least of the way that the electoral colleges communicated between the states and in Washington, D.C. Just talk briefly about that, because this is one of the things that had been really scary, has been watching Republicans assume election official positions in key states around the country who buy into Donald Trump's, you know, stolen election narrative. And the idea that this is, you know, they're setting it up for Trump, for DeSantis, for whomever it is.
Yeah, I think I said in this column that it was a good bill, and I think it is a good bill. What it does is, on the state side, it first, you know, clarifies that the only votes, electoral votes, Congress is going to count are the ones allocated according to the method present before the election, right? And so, like, if a state, like all states, allocate their electoral college votes by popular vote, and that's what happens on the election, and those are the electoral votes, those are the electors that are going to count. And this idea that's been floated among some Republicans that you can kind of like retroactively, you can say it was a fraudulent election and then like select new electors in Washington. The bill is trying to preclude that. It says that, you know, unless otherwise specifically designated in state law, it's the governor of the state who is responsible for certifying electors, and they must do so by a particular date. To avoid attempts to kind of like subvert the process after that. And if there's some sort of, you know, let's say you have some kind of MAGA secretary of state and governor and whomever who, you know, refuses to honor the results of the election, refuses to certify the electors, then the candidate can actually appeal, you know, sue basically in federal court, and it becomes an expedited process by which a panel of federal judges will decide on the where to go from this. And although this doesn't, you know, this doesn't fill me with a ton of confidence, there's been like an expedited process to go to the Supreme Court. I'll get to sort of a point I make in the column later, but that's sort of what it does on the state side. And on the congressional side, it raises the barrier to objections to electors from one member of each chamber to one fifth of each chamber. So you have to have actually like a lot of people objecting to make the objection count. It clarifies that the vice president, you know, is just there as a ceremonial thing, like has no real role other than just like to be there and announce things. And there's one more thing it does. Oh, and if there is some catastrophe that affects the election, it kind of sets procedures for when you can hold a new election, but it doesn't let states kind of just like unilaterally declare that, oh, fraud election, we gotta get rid of the electors. So it basically tries to plug the holes that Trump tried to exploit in the months between the election and January 6th. The one issue with all of this, and it's sort of two things. The first is that kind of as long as we have the Electoral College, it's going to be very tempting to pull these shenanigans because elections don't necessarily turn on millions of votes. They turn on a few thousands of votes.
Right.
And so there's going to be a real temptation, I think, going forth, as there's always been, to try to manipulate things at the county level, manipulate things at the precinct level to get rid of votes that could mean the difference between, right, sort of the presidency, right? Like a couple thousand votes in Wisconsin could mean the difference between the presidency and not the presidency. And that is purely a function of the Electoral College. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that as long as this big part of the Republican Party is more or less like opposed to honoring elections that doesn't win, you're just going to have problems, right? Like at the end of the day, you need both sides to be like, these are the procedures. This is the process. If we lose, we can try again next time. And you like honor the results and you let the winner take power. But if you have one party that's just like, we're not going to do that, no thanks. But there's really no set of rules or procedures you can like figure out that's going to like protect the system in the long term.
What are the chances this is going to pass? And then what are the chances the Supreme Court strikes it down?
Well, I think the chances it'll pass are actually pretty good. It seems to avoid anything that might like get in the way of, many Republicans, right? First of all, it has more Republican co-sponsors than Democratic co-sponsors, which is a good sign. And the other thing is that because it doesn't really deal with the administration of elections, just kind of sets parameters for deadlines and who can do what and whatnot. I think that gets, it kind of avoids the tricky spots for a lot of Republicans.
Which is expanding the franchise.
Right, exactly. Letting more people vote. That's the thing they're very upset about.
Right, of course.
The Supreme Court, like, you got to think who would sue to sort of like take this case to the court. And I can't think of anyone because the Constitution does give the Congress like explicit power to regulate federal elections. It's like a thing that the same clause that conservatives are using to advance this ludicrous argument that state legislatures can do whatever they want says, like in the very next sentence, that Congress can make regulations as it so see fits. And so this is an expressly delegated power to the Congress. There's no reason for the court to really do anything. The one caveat I would make is that, you know, the Constitution and the 15th Amendment also gives Congress the explicit power to stop discrimination in voting on the basis of race as it sees fits. It can do whatever it wants to make sure that doesn't happen. And the Supreme Court has somehow like written this out of the Constitution, right? That says essentially said this doesn't exist. So stipulating that just because the Constitution says a thing doesn't mean the court is going to acknowledge that it says that thing. That's always a danger, but at least on its face, this is a perfectly constitutional piece of legislation that the court has no real basis for overturning.
It's good that you added that qualifier, because I was gonna see if we could get a bet going. that at least the idea that would be out there is at least, you know, some assurance, but it's going to be fascinating to see in the coming months if Donald Trump jumps into the presidential race, because he's worried. It sounds like he's worried about what's happening in Georgia in terms of that investigation there. I mean, it doesn't appear that Merrick Garland is, you know, hot on the trail, as it were, but Georgia certainly seems to be vigorous. If he jumps in, with these numbers already trending this way and the announcement that there's going to be more hearings in September, which I have to say, I criticize Democrats a lot, but I think this is just brilliant that they're continuing this. I mean, it is.
They should schedule hearings for the day before the election.
Yes.
Without a doubt. And
like when you're going to vote, the last thing you should see on the news is news about the January 6th committee.
Without a doubt. I mean, it just seems to be effective. And the idea that they have this sort of open field, because there's no, you know, Republican asking questions, you know, you can imagine what the questions would have been. Jim Jordan is there and, you know, Mark Meadows, right hand woman, goes to give a testimony. And he's just like, what is a woman? You know, like that would be. The thing, hopefully they learn a lesson from it. Jamel Bowie, thank you so much of your time today. We will put a link to your last couple of pieces in the Times. I found them really fascinating, particularly on that electoral thing. I just wasn't up on that. Really appreciate you coming on today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program. We got clips from the January 6th commission. We've got a replay of Emma sneezing that we were going to cue.
I know. I think it's at least once a show. At least once a show I sneeze, but we'll see if we can get to two today.
We've got to, some IMs. We may take some phone calls as well. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help the show survive and thrive, you get the free show free of commercials, and you get the fun half, which is on occasion fun. Not always, but on occasion fun.
Yes.
Certainly always worth it. Let's put it that way. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. We will have links to for members who want the discounts that are offered by our sponsors today, including Sunset Lake Sabade, in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
Well, soon, hopefully, we'll be having Left Reckoning merchandise, but I don't know if I'm ready to announce the store name yet. But we'll be doing a think tank this weekend, and there will be a Lex stream this evening featuring David Alexis, who formerly, people might know, he was organizing a driver's co-op contra the Uber and Lyft platforms, and now he's running for office in District 21 in New York.
Sweet.
Also a fan of the show.
Awesome. Even better. What's happening with that Uber thing? I mean,
I'll ask him about it. But he's running for office now, trying to get people state health care.
Beautiful. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We may take calls. May not. 646-257-3920. I'll announce the call number when we get to the other side. Maybe, yeah, we will, I think, take calls today.
Okay.
All right. See you in the fun half.
Sorry, I can't find my mouse. Oh, yeah.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.